Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome to Brain Injury Radio Network. Tonight is our regular Wednesday installment of our program Recovery Now with your host, Kim Justice. If you'd like to know more about my story, you can find it at inaflash.org. I, too, am a fellow traumatic brain injury survivor. I appreciate you tuning in tonight, and as always, I look forward to your input. So now, we'll get on with the show. Well, hello, and happy hump night from somewhere in Middle America, where we were a balmy 27 degrees today. So winter has landed. And this is our last day in the month of November. So now for some out there will become the mad dash of stress and debt to the holidays. And for others will be some gratitude and feelings of wonder and belief and enjoying the simple pleasures, and for some, a little of both. But I'm glad you're here tonight. Thanks so much for being here. For those of you who are new around here, Recovery Now is a gathering place for anyone seeking recovery from the challenges of life on life's terms. Guests share their experience, strength, and hope. We discuss useful tools that have helped us lighten the load of our journey through recovery. More will be revealed. This is a We Recovery program because it is in the we that we find the new me. We focus on the four A's of recovery: awareness, acceptance, action, and adaptation. This is a place for survivors striving to become thrivers. And for that, it takes a good bit of warrior. Again, I'm your host, Kim Justice, author of In a Flash, Miracles Here and Beyond, and Hootie's Hollow and the Magic Tree, which for any of you owl lovers slash animal lovers out there would make a great holiday gift. You can find out more at my website, inaflash.org. And check out Hootie's Hollow and the Magic Tree. I'm not so sure that you want to gift In a Flash, although you might. If you know someone who's recently had a ruptured brain aneurysm or a near-death experience, that might be the kind of book that would make a good gift for some. But if you want something light, happy, some great pictures and some lessons from nature, I encourage you to check out Hootie's Hollow and the Magic Tree. There's links to both of those at my website, inaflash.org. They're both found on which my website gives the link. They're both found on Amazon in both book form, ebook, and audio book. So depending on what your pleasure, just a little 411 out there on a gift. Very reasonably priced and fun. Now, I would be talking, and will be, I hope, talking about another type of book with some great life lessons in it, excuse me. And the book is important, but this guest, who isn't here yet, so I may play a song while I look for him. In any case, Thomas Lane is to be my guest tonight. He's an author, but so much more. In fact, I'm trying to think of how did I describe him? Multidimensional creative. Isn't that a great title to be a multidimensional creative? Meaning, in his case, that he does art of all forms. Again, we don't want to limit the definition of art, but so many things, drawing, singing, writing, the book, poetry, and also activist type work. He's also done, did I say paintings and screenplays. Has a CD entitled Hotel Earth, and so really has, gee, is the epitome of the multidimensional creative. But until he arrives, I'm probably going to play a song when I get my phone back. My husband's trying to do me a favor, and I have to have a phone to try to get a hold of this man. So I'm going to play a song in just a couple of moments and hopefully get my phone back and find our guest and why he's not here. But I hope you guys had a great Thanksgiving. Ours was different, but it was good. It was good because got to share it with family. In a different context and venue than has been done in 60 years. So sometimes we get to the holiday season and feel a little bittersweet about things, particularly maybe now, but in the last couple of years around COVID. You know, holidays were more limited, more cut back, not what we were used to. And sometimes it's not because of a pandemic. Last time that happened was, 1918? Something like that. But when lives change and people become sick, here, you get a brain injury, whether it's a car accident or a stroke or an aneurysm or MS or Parkinson's or CTE or whatever it might be, when you change, everyone around you is forced to change. And a lot of times that's not just the people, the family, and how they cope, but it's also the physical holidays. Like if you were used to having a long Thanksgiving day with a great big meal and, you know, here we'll be sexist, the women in doing the dishes and the cleanup and the men watching the football game, and it wound up being a 7-hour day. And after your brain injury, that's just not something that you can deal with anymore. All of the yelling, not at the dinner table, of course, but from the football games that are on, the variety of conversations coming at you from every direction, the crowding, the crowding with all of the people. My husband's back with my phone, so maybe I can call our guest. Would you like to say, since you're up, you hear me talk? I know a lot of you don't believe I have a husband. I talk about Gary a lot, but I always claim he's in bed, and he is. He's an early riser. I'm the night owl, but he happened to be doing something that took away my phone, so I couldn't get my guest. So for that, I'm putting him on the spot. I want to say happy holidays to everybody, Gary.
Happy holidays, everyone. I'm a real person, and I love Kim.
Oh, that's so sweet, and I love him, too. Good night, dear.
Good night.
That's great. We'll have to keep that one for posterity. Honest to God, he is never up when the shows are on. He's in bed by an hour ago. So that was a special treat after, what, 12 and a half years of my being here every week. So now that I've got my phone back, I gave you a little intro heating up. You know, it's funny, I did try to text our guest, and it turned out he was talking to me from a landline. So Gary took my phone to fix something for me, and I couldn't get a hold of the man. So what I'm going to do is put on a song and thing. It's just November 1st. We can talk about, I heard on the news the other night, we may never get to that song or my guest, but I heard on the news the other night, they were doing a survey out on the street, and it was when you should start decorating for the holidays and playing holiday music. Some people said they like to play holiday music all year. That's probably not true in the heat of the summer, but okay. Some said you have to wait until December 1st, which, okay. Others said, you know, the lights in the city go on, the festive hustle bustle, trying to get you out, draw you out of your houses and do some shopping and be out on the town and the restaurant. So the city lights, holiday lights, come on usually the day after Thanksgiving or Thanksgiving night. So a lot of places, the holiday songs start then. And then there's others who make short work of it, and it's a little later in the month. Now, had I known that my guest wasn't going to be here right now, I would have uploaded some holiday music, and I would have started a day early, because in some coasts, we're closer to December 1st than others. But in any case, by next week, in fact, next week, I believe, is going to be open mic. I'm your host every Wednesday night. I have a couple of great shows in December. A lot of you know that I've been working on a book. Back in June, I booked through the end of the year, through the end of November anyway, and then two shows into December. And I was thinking about booking guests for the couple slots I have in December left, and I may, but on the other hand, it would be nice, you know, on Thanksgiving, I wasn't feeling well, and my show was the night before Thanksgiving. Not well enough to not make it to the family gathering the next day, but just not feeling well. A couple weeks before that had been filled with a lot of what ifs, a couple of health scares, a friend that died, just a couple of different things, and I was stretched, let's say. And in the 12 and a half years, I think I've only put on maybe six tapes when Gary and I have been fortunate enough to get away for a holiday, for our anniversary in May. But I went back, and it was about 6 years. There was a time when this network started that there were seven of us. Craig Cecilia founded the network. He did the show on his own one night a week for a couple years. And then the need was so great. There were so many people out there that could relate to what he had to say, he and his guests, that he was hearing from all over the world and decided that the show should go seven nights a week. And at that time, he was a weekly host on Mondays, and he picked out six other people. I'm one. I do Wednesday nights. And I think I'm the only original weekly host left. Anyway, back in those days when there were seven of us, we were at each other's shows quite a bit. We would come and visit each other's shows, have a lot of fun. It was like a small family. And then as we started getting bigger and natural attrition happened and someone would leave and I would think that run across someone I thought would make a good host, a great host, but they weren't able to do a weekly show, I'd put them on for twice a month or once a month. And some couple of our old weekly hosts got into some other things as life twists and turns, and they're only here once a month, if we're lucky. And they show up, and that brought about 20 people to the table. And then you didn't find, I haven't found, as much camaraderie and being at each other's shows as much and supporting each other as much and having that sense of family. Now, I'm fortunate more so than some because I'm our director of operations. I do get a chance to speak with all of our hosts, but not as much as I would like and not as much as it was in the old days. So I thought it would be a treat both for the audience and because I needed a night off last Wednesday. I went back, I think it was 5 or 6 years ago, maybe 6 years ago, and it was a Thanksgiving show, so it was timely, but it was pre-COVID, back in the good old days when there were less of us and we were a tighter group, and Les, Paul, and Craig joined me on that show, and I thought that would be fun for the longtime listeners to revisit how that show went and for the three of us to listen to see how things have changed, where we were, what it was like, what it's like now, where we may want it to be. So I hope those of you that heard the show last week who are old-timers enjoyed it. And those of you who are newcomers, I hope that you enjoyed it too. If you tried to call in and didn't get an answer, my apologies. I wasn't there. It was a tape. So it wasn't ignoring you or being rude. Certainly before the guest comes on, even right now, 424-243-9540, if you'd like to call in, go ahead and do that, and I would be happy to take your call. Now, what I am going to do, because I said I would, and I don't have a plan B going on. Oh, wait, I will go back. This is Brain Injury Radio, folks. And speak of the devil, here's one person, our good friend Ron in the chat room. So we want to say hello, Ron. Ron's in Philadelphia, and his weather is probably cold like ours is, too. We're waiting on our guest, Ron, and I'm kind of wondering what that'll be like. I was talking about last week's show, a little bit of the good old days where we had part of the original group and a six-year-old Thanksgiving show and how it was different when we all dropped in on each other. And it was like a small family, and that as we've grown, people, the hosts are more on their own with regular listeners and not so much at each other's shows. But what I was going to say is I think next week, because it will be the first week of December, I can certainly get a guest. That's not a problem, and I may. On the other hand, I may make it a call-in show and have my holiday music uploaded by then. It's kind of fun sometimes to just, well, for me, to be able to listen to the holiday music. I have a specific playlist for my show that I pull up every year. I have to upload them again to keep room in the studio and have callers and hope we have people call in and talk about the holiday, the mad dash to the holiday. I know a lot of people have lost loved ones in the last few years, whether it was from COVID or otherwise. Change happens all the time. Find out what the challenges are this holiday season, what the stressors are, what the joys are. I heard someone talking about, you know, bringing out, for me, you know, one of them is bringing out the holiday gear, which Gary and I did the weekend of Thanksgiving, and decorated. And, you know, we've had these things, but I've had some of them from, geez, decades ago. So I know they're there, but after Christmas, I don't think about them. And it's almost like not opening something new, but that kind of excitement when I take the box out and, oh, look, here's the Rudolph and Clarice water globe. And here's the, I like water globes. Here's the Sugar Plum Fairy water globe. And we've got pictures of snowy towns with sleighs that are twinkling with lights. That's what we do instead of a Christmas tree. And so maybe next week, if you'd like, prepare, set your clock for next Wednesday night. In between some festive music, we'll talk about our challenges and our joys and the simple things that make us happy around the holidays, past or present. And that'll either be me talking a lot, like I am tonight, or hopefully a lot of you with a week's notice would like to join in. In fact, I may even see if a couple of the regular listeners would like to come on for the interview, but to share something. And maybe that will be a challenge for the holiday season this year, things that bring a simple pleasure, the bitter and the sweet, the stress and the peace, the duality from Thanksgiving up until Christmas, and then you kind of pass out till New Year's. That is if you're older like we are and we don't do New Year's Eve anymore. Haven't for a lot of years. So for us, Christmas is it, and then the week off. And Gary never makes it to midnight. I do. I see midnight all the time, but, you know, yeah, it's another year. And we'll wait and see what's different. The last couple of years have been tough when it's come to the new year. I'm not going to do a show on, what do you call those things I don't do? Resolutions. Don't believe in resolutions for the new year. Believe in goals, trying to make some reasonable goals, attainable goals, and not to reach too far, but not to be too lame either. So with that, I am going to put on a song, and I might want to put on one, let's see, I think I'll put on John Cruise Blues, because that's a little longer. Gives me time to call this man. Anyway, I'm going to put on John Cruise Blues and try to get a hold of our guest, Thomas Lane, and hope that he's okay. He is in the East Coast, so perhaps, you know, that time zone thing gets in the way sometimes. But this is called Palm of Your Hand, and I will be right back, with or without a guest. Thank you. That was John Cruise, everybody, a song I know that a lot of you like. And I mentioned that our guest tonight is also a musician. And I love the term multidimensional artist. I talked to you a little bit about that. But I want to just tell you a quick anecdote about John Cruise. And then my bad. And apologies to my guest. I made an error in the promo I sent him. I was talking to you about how my last couple weeks has been hectic, and what do they call that on the news? I sent him some misinformation, so my bad, and apologies, and I'm going to bring him on in 1 second, but just a little quick thing about John Cruise. You know, there's a lot of starving artists out there, and John, I won't go in because I don't want to cut into our guest's time any more than I did already, but the circumstances under which I met him was when he was performing locally here in town. But I found out that he was a painter, not of pictures, but of houses by day. And when my husband and I moved here 8 years ago, it had been a long time since I had run into John, except at the Blues Festival. You can probably hear, and those of you that have heard know he sings the blues. In fact, he said when Adam met Eve, that's when the blues began. Anyway, decided to have John paint our new house, and we hadn't moved in yet. We wanted to get the work done before we moved all our stuff in. So I was over here when there was workmen remodeling, and John was doing the painting, and he came back to get paid, not because I didn't pay him. He had a little more work to do, but he had changed his clothes, and I told him to bring back his guitar. And there's a thing on YouTube, if any of you want to see it, I'll send it to you, but he sings actually a gospel song, I believe. But in the corner, in a chair in the corner of my living room that he had just painted, he sat down, and I sat on the floor in front of him with my Stone Age cell phone, taping him sing this song in our new living room. He played the first note. This is not on the tape. Sang a couple of bars, and he said, "Boy, the acoustics are really good in this room." No furniture in there, and I guess they were. Anyway, John always sounds good to me, but he sang that song in my living room, and I was tickled with that, thinking about meeting him a decade and a half before, never having met him before, and he was singing that song, Palm of Your Hand. And to have him sitting there in the corner and me sitting on the floor in front of him, taping him in our living room that he just painted, was a trip. It was really a trip. But anyway, with my guest, I'm very excited. Thomas Lane. And I had a really nice conversation the other day, and I know I've really been looking forward to the show tonight. Author, poet, and musician Thomas Lane will discuss his new release, The Karma Factor, a work of visionary fiction exploring the boundaries of human consciousness against the backdrop of a classic suspense thriller. With a purpose that transcends the gender, Lane expertly weaves the novel's wider message in a groundbreaking white-knuckle ride between worlds as characters set out to make karmic amendments, right wrongs, and reestablish the power of choice. His captivating thriller reveals the mystery of human existence through an extraordinary twist of fate. Thomas Lane is a multidimensional creative drawn to spaces where art, spirit, and social justice intersect. He is also the author of the Artist's Manifesto, a tribute to the power of the arts and its value to a society that has forgotten the precious nature of life. In addition to creating a collection of poetry, screenplays, and paintings, he recorded a CD of his songs entitled Hotel Earth under the stage name Tracker, T-R-A-K-K-E-R, Tracker. For more, see his website, thomaslane.com. And I'm really happy tonight. We're not only going to talk about the book, The Karma Factor, which I will say I was sent a copy of the book, and my husband walked through the kitchen. I don't put anything else on my stove, and so my mail was sitting stacked on the stove. I had unwrapped the book. It was on the counter, and my husband came and was so taken by the book cover. And Thomas Lane, I'm going to have to ask him if that's his real name. It sounds like a great pen name. But anyway, between the picture and the title and the dynamic of the whole thing, it resonated with my husband, and he picked it up and he took it to his nightstand, but I didn't know it. And my show was coming up with Tom, and I was like, where the heck is that book? We on Brain Injury Radio understand that, you know, we can look all day for a pair of glasses that's up on our head. So I was looking all over for the book and finally said to Gary, hey, do you remember? And he was like, yeah, it looked great. I took it. It's in the other room. And so he started reading the book, The Karma Factor, and so far it's as suspenseful and visionary as I just read that it was. So with that, I'm not going to keep him any longer, except to say I always put the website in my program notes. So we're going to be mentioning it more than once tonight. But if you want to know more about Thomas Lane and you're driving or sitting in your easy chair and you don't have a pen right there, always know that you can go back. The show is on demand, so whatever link you might be clicking on right now to listen to the show, I've posted all over social media, LinkedIn, all the usual haunts. You can go to braininjuryradio.com or my website, inaflash.org, and the show's there already. You press the same link. But all you have to do is press the link to bring it up if you already heard the show, and you'll always find the relevant website there. So thomaslane.com, and with that, we're going to bring on the real multidimensional creative Thomas Lane. Welcome to the show. How you doing?
Wow, what an intro. My Lord. Thank you for having me. It's amazing. Amazing. Thank you so much.
Happy to have you. Happy to have you. I told you, and this is going to just lead to a little bit of background on you and your history, but I told Tom that I was envious in a good way, happy for him, nothing in a bad way, except that I found in my life that I've played to expectations for a lot of my life. And I saw his mom and dad's pedigree, and my mom and dad have a similar pedigree, and they had some expectations for me. And so I went that direction, and it was not my direction. And it was damaging, you know,
yeah.
It was damaging. I did it,
mm-hmm.
But in the world of to thine own self be true, I wasn't for more than half of my life. And when I read about Tom's background, and I'm going to let him tell you about that, what I was envious about is, wow, pardon my language, but here's somebody that had the nads to know what he didn't want, know the things he wanted to try, and went out and did it. And before I turn him loose, I just want to say, for those of you out there, especially in our audience, you know, any day of the week, you can make a choice to start over. And if you've had a brain injury or something that's taken you out of your world or turned your life upside down and you're feeling hopeless or helpless, we're going into the holidays and sometimes that makes it even worse. You know, tonight we're going to talk about a lot of things, but one of the things up front for me in having met Thomas is a message of hope, because if there are things that you've wanted to try your whole life and you've thought, I wouldn't be any good at it, or, oh, what would people think of me for it? Or, and you've had this whole dialogue in your head that's kept you on the bench instead of getting out on the field and playing or trying. Don't let it, because tonight we have the example of someone who was blessed to do it at a young age, but you can do it right now. I did it 12 years ago. You can do it starting tomorrow if you want to. So with that, why don't you tell us a little bit about you, your history, and how you started before we get into the book. Just kind of, I talked before you came on, poet, painter, activist, author, musician, and tonight I just did want to say, at some point a little bit later, we're going to play a song that Tom has graciously given me to play tonight so you can connect the song with the man, and then I'll be playing a few other of his songs, adding them to my playlist in the future, and I appreciate that, so it's pretty cool. We've got some new tunes to hear and a new great author to be introduced to. And I did mention at the beginning of the show that we're on the last day of November. Thanksgiving, most people have digested by now, and tomorrow the mad dash for Christmas is going to be on. And Thomas's book, I think, if my husband's reaction was any, and all of his reviews, check them out on his website, or on Amazon, are any indication that that would make a great book for friends that, you know, like suspense, thriller, and you'll hear more about it type of books, or the CD, and you'll get the opportunity to hear a sample of the music tonight. Great possible gifts for the holidays coming up. And with that, now I will shut up. I got to rattling when in the beginning of the show, and so now I'm going to drop the mic and give it to you for a little bit.
Wow, well, thank you so much. You know, I just want to say right from the start is that, you know, we have barely talked, but I got the sensation of you and your courage, and it just the story you told about the singer-painter and how it impacted you and how you responded to it. And it's just in your space, this kindness that you have. And so I would turn around and have them, your listeners here also, and I'm sure they do, that's why they listen to you, is the depth and the kindness that you bring to this moment is really extraordinary. I just wanted to start with that.
Well, thank you so much.
Absolutely.
I try.
Well, you do more than that. the background story. In a funny way, I knew very, very young. I come from a family of Harvard and Yale PhDs, Columbia, and then there was me. And I knew right from the get-go, you know, the little joke is I didn't hear just another drummer. I heard an entirely different orchestra. And I didn't mm-hmm. know what that was. Back then, I just felt, well, here I am. And I remember crawling. I was that young when I looked and I saw my family, and they're wonderful people. And there's tremendous amount of intelligence and strength and goodness. It just wasn't working out in that environment. And I looked over there and said, oh, I'm glad I'm not them. And I didn't even realize it how deep and how sort of buried that was as I was going off in my own direction. And it wasn't so much an act of courage. It was that there wasn't any option, that I had to follow whatever this was. And it was sports. And then as I told you, Kim, I was getting along fine in very young in school, in elementary school. And then things started to shift in the family, making it uncomfortable for me. And then I happened on The Hobbit. My fourth grade teacher read The Hobbit out loud. And
I love The Hobbit.
The Hobbit.
Bilbo Baggins.
It was, oh, my God. And for, you know, coming from a very intellectual, sort of ambitious, driven type environment at home, suddenly there was this magical character who was kind of cute and little and yet tough and had great integrity. And it opened up what turned into a spiritual quest for me, just about an alternative viewpoint and a lens that allows for dragons and magic and also sorrow. And it started to get, the seed got planted there. And then I had a difficult time in all schools, in all situations. I was in high school, three different high schools, including a Quaker boarding school. I went away to school for a while. And then I lived in New York for a year, going to a school there. Then I went to the University of Chicago. And I kept trying to find the right school for me until I had the amazingly simple awareness that it just, school and me do not fit. It just was wrong. And bless the hearts of all that can follow paths like that. But then again, I stopped going to classes. I played guitar and I wrote songs. And I had my first sort of past life experience. This is the University of Chicago, in one of their great old churches, which was also a coffee shop. And I remember sitting there, and I was performing there. And all of a sudden, something went slightly out of focus. And I went, oh, my God, I've been here. Not here in Chicago, but in some – it was a Gothic kind of structure, 1500s maybe, something like that. And I went, wow, could this be true? And, I mean, it was a sensation. It's, you know, I was slammed back into, you know, what's my next song going to be? And does my girlfriend love me? And, you know, all that kind of good stuff. But that grew as I then turned to Eastern philosophy and, you know, tried to work out what this difference was that I felt about me, and sort of having the role of an outsider. But it wasn't because I was embittered or I was a misanthrope or any of that. It was just I felt like this culture, and as it, you know, grew and I grew with it through the years, was something that was foreign to me, and that, you know, I wasn't better, I wasn't worse, but I was somehow could not get a latch in that society. So I spent, you know, and I discovered poetry and literature and songs, Bob Dylan stuff, Leonard Cohen stuff from way back when. Had a publishing deal when I was 15. Yep. Oh, well, you know, probably. I had a publishing deal when I was 15. I thought, oh, good. Well, I'll just be a folk singer or some such, and it didn't get off the ground. But anyway, through the years, it was how to navigate being on the outside and yet, you know, feeling great love and passion for humanity and for not all humanity, God knows, but I believe in the storylines of particularly those in the progressive movement and the spiritual movements, that something really special and some miracle was operating underneath it all and trying to be expressed. And my job, and this is why I gave myself the name Tracker, as that's the musician name.
Yeah, was that, I want to know that.
Well, it was just that somehow I found that I was, that one of the advantages of being an outsider was that I didn't have expectations to live up to, just what you were talking about, Kim. And that I was master of my own ship, but then where do I steer this thing? How do I get by? How do I pay rent? How do I keep the muses fed? You know, and I had a lot of them. I started out writing poetry, then it was music, and then it was folk music, then it was rock music, and went through various stages with music. Then I wrote a book that never got published, and this and that, and then I ended up, because I was so upset with the art industries, this is a while ago, the whole music scene was being run and dominated by lawyers and money people, and that the artist had somehow been convinced that he or she could not make money, could not be self-sufficient. They had to have these power brokers and this and that. And that's changed in the internet to some degree. But I did interviews of artists of all the different kinds of arts that I could, you know, get my hands on, from stand-up comedians to writers and musicians and poets and dancers. They were all saying the same thing. They were all saying, you know, we are dispensable. We are, because of the way it's set up, is that the arts have no power. Other than, you know, if you're Beyonce or someone huge, then that's one thing. But there seems to be sort of no middle class for artists. And this, you know, this is not factually driven. This is gut for me. You know, you have to have two or three other jobs just to get some kind of money so you can have a little bit of time to do your art. And anyway, I don't know what the answer is. I just felt that the artist is in all of sort of the activities is the one through imagery and word choice, and they affect consciousness. They change it. They have the power that you know, transcends armies or governments, because it goes to the centerpiece. It goes to the heart. And because of that, we are beloved by, you know, we're not representing an oil company or something of personal interest. We're representing, hopefully, the consciousness of America or whatever country. So anyway, I got very caught up in that. And then, you know, it kind of, you know, some things happened financially for me. I wrote this thing called The Karma Factor way back. And it went through heartache after heartache as you know, people got very excited about making it into a movie or a TV show. And Roseanne Barr, this is back 15 years ago or something, she wanted to turn into a TV show. She gathered all her Warner Brother people at that point, and she had the rights to say, I wanted this to be a TV show. And she said, Mr. Lane, don't say anything. Keep your mouth shut. I'll handle everything. And so we get in the room with all the hot shots, And they say, we don't understand this thing. What is it? And she said, Tom, take it away. And I was, it didn't, obviously it didn't go anywhere, and it's probably a good thing. But anyway, just to answer your that is a thumbnail of basically, you know, for me, I was like hand to mouth. I got by. Sometimes I had help from my folks. But I, you know, I sold stuff on street corners. I sold newspapers. I did some construction work. I worked as a waiter, dishwasher, all that stuff, just so I could live another day as a creative. And that was the commitment. And life has been very kind to me in that sense, that I'm able to do that now. I had another source of income. But, you know, it's really difficult to do what Kim was talking about, to move from, see, I was always outside. So for me, it was, you know, courage has to do with the relative sense of danger. For some people, walking across the street, you know, on a walker is as courageous as storming a Nazi nest of machine gun fire. And for me, it wasn't that an adversary, just to try to be me, try to grow up, try to, you know, be a decent human being and create art that I believe in. How's that? I just took
that's
up
pretty cool.
Minutes. Oh, thanks.
That's
for listening.
All right. No, I'm glad that you did, because it really is a challenge. Art is so expressive, you know, when you're, because I did go the other way through business. I mean, I've always been authentic, but you have to be authentic within the limits of that world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they don't think you're a flake in
right.
that pigeonhole. You know what I'm talking about? In that pigeonhole.
Absolutely.
So I had to be, you know, who I was there. And it paid well. There's the trade-off, okay? Because for the last 12 years, you know, I've been working on my third book and been volunteering doing radio, and now I'm a advocate activist too. And it, you know, the man who started this network, I'll just tell you just real briefly, because I mean, you look at it and where I left off, you know, we were buying albums. That was the first time, kids, that vinyl came out.
Yeah.
It's not new, honest. It was a long time ago. We had speakers as tall as we were that, you know, blew the roof off the house when we played them. But, you know, in fact, I go back to 8 tracks, for God's sake. I don't want to give myself away. But, you know, it got expensive, you know, when you were that age. And, you know, you liked 2 or 3 songs, but you had to buy the album. You know,
right.
And I don't know what they were when I left off, 13, 15 bucks, something like that. And heaven forbid your fave put out a double album, you know, or something. I remember, do you remember Grand Funk, Mark, Don, and Mel?
Yes, I remember the name. I don't know if I got
and
into them back then.
I'm Your Captain and Heartbreaker, and they were okay. Yeah, it takes you way back. You'll have to look them up on YouTube, except they only have what I call the home show version now, because everybody we grew up with who is, you know, young and hot back then are our age now. It's not quite the same when they're
how dare
performing
they get
those
old.
Songs
that's,
now.
They're not
how
supposed to
dare
get old.
They? I know, and I don't know that they made cameras back before that. But anyway, the guy who does this network is a prolific songwriter and guitarist and piano. And when I got here and met him, he was on a big label. And he had had his bad car accident, traumatic brain injury. And the thing was that I thought was really unfair, and this is, I think, before I wrote my book. I don't know. I can't remember. But similar analogy across the board and all those arts you were talking about. You know, under label, they were always either, I mean, every breathing minute, they were either traveling to a destination to perform or they were in the studio. I mean, slave dogs, you know, doing this to be on the label. And they did a European tour, and they were like, I don't know, Germany one day and France the next day and wherever the next day. And and it was just, you know, he was getting really tired. And sometimes the flashing lights and the loud noise can cause people with brain injury some grief, seizure, for example. And he had a seizure halfway through this tour on stage, and it wasn't the traditional kind you would think of, but it was, there's, I found out since I got here, there's a lot of different kinds of seizures. But anyway, he had a seizure. It scared the hell out of him. He left. He got on a plane and left and came home. And they sued him. The label sued him for breach of contract. And they fought for 2 years. But, you know, one adage, you can't get blood out of a turnip, right? So they hounded his ass like devil dog for, pardon me, Marines, not like devil dogs. I don't mean you. Semper Fi. But, you know, just they were like animals, considering that he had been sick. It wasn't like he just split because he was partying. Yep. He didn't party, you know, amazingly enough. You don't find that very often. But they did. They pursued him rabid all the time, you know, lawyer, whatever, screwing with him for 2 years. At the end, when they found out they were not going to get the money, they could take everything he had, and it, you know, wasn't going to dent their pocket.
Right.
It cost him, and thank God he was, as he can wake up in the middle of the night not able to sleep and rip off four or five songs that are good.
Wow.
It cost him 100 songs to get out of the contract.
Wow. Did some of them get charted and do well and...
Well, he's not, he wasn't supposed to say anything that I just said. That's why I didn't mention the company. But the thing is about that whole deal, and you would know the artist and the integrity of the artist and what you were feeling when you wrote things, is that those 100 songs can sit on a shelf in dust for the rest of their life. They can go to a band that's a completely different kind of band that can bastardize the song from what was originally written and intended.
Right.
That's happened a couple of times. And so that's got to be, I don't know, what would be more heartbreaking. All of that sweat equity and feelings and what it took you to do that sitting on a shelf. Where no one's going to use it ever, and it's going to be there, or having some punk band pick it up and make it sound like you don't even recognize it. But, you know, that was the cost of doing business. But my whole point is, you know, you look at the songs now, because he, I've been with him long enough, you know, he had whatever, resentment, depression, whatever spectrum of feelings you'd have after having a long, drawn-out experience like that. And he lost his taste for music. You don't lose the music, you know, and I knew that, and our other hosts were bugging him, you've got to. And I just shut up, because I knew it would come back to him when he was ready for it to come back to him, because you don't lose that talent.
Right.
He had to go through what he had to go through, you know. So then, a number of years later, he got together with the same couple people and slightly changed the name of the band and became an indie. You know, and I'm watching now, you know, when you go to buy a song, you know, the people got their wish. They could buy their two favorite songs. But, you know,
yeah,
it's $1.69 or whatever the hell it is. And, you know, Amazon or Apple get 40% and you get 60%. Well, that's a lot of dimes, you know, to rub together month in, month out to create any kind of income, you know. It's very difficult to be a creative, yet you put some of that out and it resonates with people in a different way. I can think of one song of his, and I know what was on his mind when he wrote it, but when I heard it, and it resonated so deeply in my core, it was for my reasons, right? For my reasons that I had no idea what was on his mind when he wrote it.
Right.
You know, but when I heard it, it was like a spiritual experience. Anyway, that happens all the time, you know, with music and books that people write. They're game-changing, life-changers for people.
Yeah.
And it's so important, you know. But, you know, the service I did before was great, swell. I got paid for it. But it didn't feed my soul. And the stuff I've been doing for free has been what my soul, but thank God I have a husband. You know, I probably couldn't afford to do this if I didn't have that support, you know, to be able to do these things that have fed my soul. And I feel so blessed to have gotten the opportunity to be doing that, but it's sure not easy to do. That's for sure.
Amen to that.
I read, it's just, it's crazy. And you know, when that album concept went away, it should come back. You know, they did wind up doing a farewell tour, and it was the equivalent of a 5-album set. And then, unfortunately, and I think that taste is gone again for a while for another reason, but his 20-year drummer passed away during COVID.
Oh, my.
He was from both bands. And so not making any music right now, but ironically, they had done their farewell tour because they were going to stop, you know, after all these years. Try something different, but they had just gotten it done and they were to leave on their first tour, I mean, the first destination on the tour, and COVID hit.
Yeah.
And so they made the 5 albums, paid for the studio time, the music's out there, but they never got to tour.
Hmm.
At all. And so it's sure not easy to be able to do that, but
I used to
say that I worked for big bucks and now I work for soul bucks, and I've got to say that can't be discounted because it's grand for those, if there are some that you know, I haven't happened to meet any, but that happened to get both, you know, both of those things.
Mm-hmm.
But for those that don't, and that goes back, you know, you said Beyonce, whoever, you know, that's luck of the draw, who you know, that old saying we've had forever, it's who you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was talking about influencers the other night, and I said, you know, some of these people that are influencers haven't done shit, excuse me, their whole life, except have a last name that's recognizable.
Right.
And you want your kid following that? You know, seriously, where are we? You know, where are we?
Where are we indeed?
Which leads me to your book. That's a segue to the book. What made you, you said that you, that's a very interesting story, by the way, about Roseanne and the karma factor, but what inspired you to write the karma factor and tell people a little about the book and its wider message that makes it relatable to all of us?
Yeah. I just want, just to go back, because the whole art scene is really, you know, dug deep into my soul, speaking of souls. And I just, the reason I'm here talking to you is because what I felt in this sort of pivotal moment with all the stuff going on now, it's all hitting the surface, all the stuff that's been buried, you know, it's a time of the big lie, but it's also a time of huge honesty, I find, with people, you know, coming forward and talking about their issues and sharing things and working together. And as I said before, and as you so eloquently stated, about the power of art, and that, in fact, the derivation, which I really pay attention to, it's really fun to look up where words come from, and they're very, very interesting. The word art comes from, one of the derivations comes from the Latin, which is ars artis, which means to join together. That's the derivation of the word art. And when you think about it, you know, because a painter puts brushstrokes together, a dancer puts motion together, a poet puts words together, musician, whatever. They also bring people together from all the different walks of life. But the one thing, and this was the sort of the key to the manifesto, which I was talking about before, and I'm reworking on updating that thing or that book, was that this is the time for artists to really step forward. I felt it in my soul with all the things happening that I needed. I've been sitting on so much product. I've been quite reclusive, and I have not really wanted to get into the scene of being a such and such or a musician. I didn't like the scene. I love rock and roll. I could play it and whatever, but I don't like living the life of it, just the way you had discussed it.
Yeah.
But I, you know, it was like, I feel like this is an all hands on deck time, and whatever deck, there are millions and billions of decks, and they can all be, you know, stepping forward to do just a little bit more. You know, even a waving to the postman, or taking a sign and going out and picketing or activating or writing a song, whatever. And I didn't really want to get out into the scene, but I felt that what my deck had to do with creating art. And so having a little bit of money and some time, is that's why I pushed to get the book published and the record made and these various things. So at least somehow with great good fortune, some of these works of mine will get out there and contribute. And so that's the overview in terms of where this karma factor. I thought about it a lot. As I said, it started in alternative universes, probably with The Hobbit. But the thought that I love action adventure stuff. I read a lot of it. I like noir movies and all of that, and I like the pace and the drama of these things. But I'm also been, you know, living trying to live a more spiritual, awakened life, and doing right by the world as well as right by me. And so I had this concept with, you know, it's the world being a place of magic and horror and grit, but magic also. And so I wanted to put something together that was really how I experienced it, which was that it's tough, it's hard, it's hard work. And yet there are these moments where you catch a glimpse, if not fill yourself up with, this moment of, oh, my God, this is a miracle that this is happening.
Mm-hmm.
And weaving those two things together, it's really the karma factor came out of my discovery of the Akashic Records. I don't know if your listeners know about that particular thing. Have you been over that in your show?
No, why don't you give a brief overview of that?
Brief, and again, this is a book of, this is fiction. I am no expert in these things. But the Akashic Records.
That's why we'll make it brief.
Yeah, I have a couple words. It's out there. It's mystical. Done. It is supposedly, it is, and nobody knows kind of who set it up or whatever, but it's part of the etheric world, is that it's a database. The Akashic Records, very old. It's, you know, pre-Egyptian, I believe. I'm not sure where it started. But it is the database of past lives. In other words, on the premise that we are born, we die, we live again in another form, in another human form or animal form, whatever, and we keep coming back, supposedly, as I understand it, to get it really, really right, so you can then have what the Buddhists call nirvana, which is that state of grace, or heaven, or however you want to frame that. But that this is an ongoing record such that, and this is in my, you know, sort of, I had to write a book about it that had action-adventure, so I couldn't go too etheric on it. But it's basically like a library that has, what were you doing on October 2nd, 1415? What did you have for breakfast, you know, in 2006 BC? Who did you kill? Et cetera. It's all there in the records, supposedly. And there are people who claim they can access those records and read from those I can't say the histories. So I thought, what an amazing idea that there might be such a thing. If not, it is fiction. What if a cop is having trouble tracking a serial killer, which is sort of the basic thing, and he, through all kinds of wonderful and mischievous means, finds out that there is this database of past lifetime and there is this serial killer out at large killing Americans. And there seems to be some kind of overall theme, motif that this guy is enacting. It's like, you know, certain behavior, one keeps repeating over and over and over again till somebody takes the needle off the record and says, you're done. You don't have to do that anymore. You can live a normal life, maybe. So what if this past lifetimes became like a police profile on, you know, Joe Smith, and that he was born in such and such, his father beat him when he was a kid, he committed his first crime. You have all this database of a criminal, and this is hopefully that you can find leads to tracking this person down, or themes. He hates redheads. Whatever. And by this, you will suddenly get, and this guy is mysterious, nobody's ever seen him, this assassin, and he takes out major people. So suddenly it becomes possible that my detective, who's a blue-collar guy who stumbles into his own past lifetime and realizes he was in Tibet, blah, 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 not to give it all away. But so he's looking, he's going back in time in these records to find out, where is this guy stuck? Why is he repeating this? Why is he murdering this kind of person in this kind of space, you know, environment? And so by that, he can then start anticipating where this guy's going to show up next. Is that, am I being clear?
Yeah, very
good.
Interesting.
Oh, yeah, it changes everything. And, you know, because in my premise, people, when they're, you know, when they're initially, when they come into this world, they carry burdens from the past, which is, you know, you could say it's baggage from family, or you could say it's baggage from a couple hundred years ago in a previous lifetime, etc. But you could also say that, you know, if you were able to handle that, if you were able to become aware that you're not right, you're not being yourself, you're being somebody back then, and become accountable, and you're willing to say, you know, I shouldn't have killed that person, or just somehow come to terms that you have done this thing, and you're acting it out, that would help you handle your bad karma. So my detective is trying to catch this guy before the police do. See if this makes sense. Because what the police will do, if they catch him first, before my somewhat awakened policeman has a chance to deal with the soul, to get inside that soul and say, you're not this person who's killing people. You are something wonderful. You are something pure and beautiful underneath it all. Contact that. So, you know, that's not how he does it. But this is what they are trying to handle then, is get somebody to have some awareness of who they have been so they can be released from that spell kind of thing that person is acting out. And so that's the premise that my detective has to grow. He's not just a New York cop who's kind of suicidal at the very beginning of the book, and then things happen such that his life is saved by some mysterious forces, and he goes, well, if I've been saved, what am I here for? What am I supposed to do? And that launches him on this whole quest to find out what the hell is going on with this. And so he can then be effective with this new paradigm. Because what I was saying was why he has to get the criminal before the police do is because the police will just put him in jail and execute him or keep him there for 40 years, and he comes out a more hardened criminal, a more, you know, desperate person, a more angry person. And so he's not cleaned up at all. When he comes back, supposedly, in this particular paradigm, he will be worse. It gets swept under the carpet, and then it comes back to haunt the society that he's living in. So I don't know that. So that this whole idea of putting these two things together, this 80% cop and robber thing, and there's a love story in there as well, just became really enchanting. And I wrote it as a novella, and that's when we went through the Roseanne Barr thing. And we finally, she did not get her deal. And so she fell out of the picture. And then I got a movie option deal, which I've had for years. I get paid, thank God, but we haven't gotten the movie made. But it's been, you know, years, decades with this book. And I've tried writing screenplays and episodes and TV shows. I've spent thousands and thousands of hours on this. I wrote the novel after, you know, deciding that it needed to be sort of formalized into a real book. And then I just recently, you know, as I said, when it became clear to me that my comfort zone was not the right way to go in this time of peril and possibility, to come out there and get on a talk show like yours and, you know, do whatever I can to get this book of mine that I hope will contribute to having a rich time with it or benefiting from it. And it's been a real heartache, elation, but ultimately wonderful journey. And I'll say one thing, which is what has really, really helped me keep the artist going despite all reasons not to. I also inherited a trust fund from a grandfather that went to help me found a nonprofit 501c3 organization, which has done a lot of charitable work with homeless folks and with and also just basically grants and donations to groups. But I you know, I'm trying on all cylinders to do, you know, what's organic with me and what has a chance to maybe make a contribution.
First of all, in the book, that just sounds fascinating because there are people that would write, you know, just try to write an explanation from a more academic standpoint, I guess, about the records. And the fact that you've put it in the form that you have, I think, is so much more powerful because it really shows, by the way, your detective is kind of in a race with time to affect an outcome or potential outcome, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Was really imaginative. That's yeah. So Bilbo Baggins of you, so imaginative of you to present the idea in that way. I just think that that's really super fascinating. And so I think, you know, as like I said, as opposed to picking up a book that just talks about the records, which I've seen a couple. I think it comes from, seems like I first heard about it somewhere in yoga, so it must be Sanskrit of some kind.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking of it as being a database that holds all
yeah.
of the happenings or the passages of your
yeah.
of your life. But if
yeah.
you had someone do that in a what they believe to be a nonfiction kind of way, I don't know if they'd be able to do that. But anyway, because that's assuming it's anyway.
There are
that.
Books
so
I have read them. I've talked to people who do readings. It's very, very different from I had to make it plausible in a way, sort of Newtonian, and have
yeah.
brick and mortar aspects to it. Otherwise,
mm-hmm.
it gets too filmy, too gauzy. You know what I mean? And I wanted to have it real clear, real clean rules of the game, and there are quite a few, which you know, I had to come up with a lot of devices. But the devices were based on, you know, there's fingerprints, and then what I have is soul prints. And those are the soul prints that are attached to the soul, not to the body. So they follow the spirit wherever he goes, which is a way that he can be tracked. And, you know, but it was like fingerprints enough, so it's like, oh, I can see that. You know, it wasn't an aura or something more etheric.
Right, and that's what I think is going to make it more powerful and successful, frankly, is when people realize that is a possibility, a real possibility put in this fiction form where someone is showing how it works and doing the thriller part of it. You know, you won't lose a person's interest where they're just going to make a judgment about
right.
whether those records exist or not. I think a person would actually lean toward the fact of thinking that something along these lines does exist by
mm-hmm.
the way you've played it out and chosen to write it. So I commend you on that.
Well, thank you.
That's
I got a call
super
from.
Cool.
Thank you. I got a call from, and I won't mention names, but very, very successful film producer. And I guess he had glanced at the book. I'm not sure he was talking about it. This is on the movie deal thing. And he said, well, you can make him like a Superman, right? He's not a human. I said, no, that's the whole point. He could be every man. He's not sophisticated. He's not particularly, he doesn't meditate all day. He doesn't jump over buildings, you know, and that makes him real. And this is just to back up your point that I had much more fun with him because he was confined by gravity and human conditions, et cetera. He was one of the guys.
Well, and that's what makes it more believable, you know, if it were Superman or, you know, somebody like that, that takes the part of it that might be reality out of it, then it's completely and totally fantasy. It sounds like you're walking a interesting tightrope between the reality, possible fantasy. Some believe it's reality, but you present it in a way that people could really look at the concept as being authentic, and you couldn't have done that by making it a superhero.
Right.
It could only be done by being a regular person doing this and making it the mission in what you prescribed. I was just reading somebody in the chat, if he's clairvoyant, then fiction becomes reality. Yeah, kind of like that. Very good, Ron, in the chat room. We're paying attention out there. No, that's a good thought. That's kind of what I was trying to say. Thank you for the help out there. Anyway, I think that is just super good. I did glance at your questions, although you see I haven't been line listing your questions like I said I wouldn't, but do you believe in reincarnation?
I have considered how I should answer that. It's an obvious question, and I think I was the one that put it on that list. Yes, I do. And it's not as real to me as the chair I'm sitting on. It's not as distant and speculative as, I don't know, a rainbow. You know, it's somewhere in the middle where I've had certain recalls, like sort of like the one I was telling you about in the chapel at Chicago, where things go slightly, and then there's this slightly different tinge. Like, where am I? I'm not in Chicago. Where am I? And I've had a few of those things, and I've, you know, with people, particularly with family and loved ones and ones that I'm close to, apparently, you know, one goes through lifetimes with a certain group of folks, or you tend to be with them again and again and again. I don't know about that so much. But there's, you know, whether it's true or not, I thought, well, gosh, if you really believe in past lifetimes, that'll change everything. Well, it doesn't really, not for me. You got to be a decent guy, no matator if you were Attila the Hun or Cleopatra or some, you know, deer in the forests of Spain. I mean, whatever you were, you're here now working it out. And as one sage said, you know, you want to know what your karma is? Look exactly where you are right now. And that's, you know, whatever weaknesses or whatever, that's what you need to work on, wherever it came from. There's other things that just because I'm a speculative guy, I start thinking about, you know, how they have made scientific pronouncements about that we all started in Africa and that we're all basically our genomes, you know, our genetic, our bodies started there, and you know, you can see the DNA showing up in Iraq and Egypt and then Canada and whatever. And so there's a kind of a unity, if we could ever get there, that we're all from a similar place. The thing about past lifetimes is that if you really can stretch out and just, you know, go imaginative on this, if that you were black one lifetime and the next lifetime you were KKK, if you were a king one lifetime and then you were a rebel fighting the, you bounce around between all the different, you've been black, you've been a woman, you've been a man, you've been someone with leprosy, you've been, you know, a magician, all those things that keep us diverse and in tribal form completely break down if one assumes or believes that we've all had different, we've walked in different shoes. We really have. You know, through time, well, how would that, if we really said, okay, this seems true, how that might help us as a community, and allowing for all the diversity, allowing for people who have walked in all these different kind of shoes to say, yeah, there's a commonality here that is not being expressed. Think big, think back, think far out, and know that we're all brothers and sisters, you know. I mean, that's just me. But I love the idea of that.
The only reason I asked, I don't judge it one way or another. I had a near-death experience, and it didn't touch on reincarnation. You know, there's other people that say when you make it to the pearly gates, you know, they go through a book, maybe the same one of your life. And we can talk about that some other time. Anyway, I think your book is fascinating, the way that you put it together.
Thank you.
To present this idea, I think that's just a real stroke of ingenuity and imagination to present it this topic the way that you did, instead of trying to go a couple of those other directions that you mentioned that I've heard before. I wouldn't finish and I would be judging, and you've got a story to get caught up into where you don't have a chance to do that. You know, you're
right.
Part of the story, going with the story, and then you can think about that afterward instead of stopping dead in your tracks, you know. Because it's meant to be fiction, but it's based on something that a lot of people think are true. In my case, it was a spiritual journey, but yeah. I didn't get to the point where I was recycled, if you will. Well, in a way, I was. I was sent back here because I made it to what I would call the pearly gates, the people that say that they've been to heaven, let's say. And I don't judge that either, if that's what they think. My personal belief is that if you make it to the other side, that you don't really come back, because your business here is completed. And maybe you do reincarnate after that. But in my personal case, I made it to where I could see evidence that we're spiritual beings, and that we leave our body and our spirit transcends to the spiritual plane. But at the pearly gate part of it, for that analogy, those loved ones, that group you're talking about that you travel with, see, there's so many similarities that there is a kernel of truth in, no matter how you tell the story, you know, that they present as people you know before you cross over, or as what I call familiars.
Hmm.
And
well, it sounds like you've done a lot of work in this area.
Well, I no, because I just figured no. No, the end of my story is that when I made it, when I was in a coma, I got to that point. I saw my grandfather. We were really close. I was the only grandchild for 18 years, still the only man who could get me out of bed at 4 o'clock in the morning to go fishing. I was his fishing buddy. And I saw him, and I wanted to go. I wanted to cross over. Gladly, but you don't have an awareness of what's behind you. It's the wonder, it's the magic, you know, that you talk about. It's the wonder of what's ahead of you, and you're not thinking about, you know, that vent you were still on, you know, that you were just on, and, you know, that's not even there. You've just, you know, your spirit is left and is on its own journey. And I wanted to cross. I took that step to cross. And it was telepathically communicated that it wasn't my time to go. And so it was as if I hit plexiglass in a way, because I took the step. Had it been up to me, I'd be there. But it wasn't up to me.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so all I could take from that is that I saw evidence that there's something beyond the here and now that we're in right now, that we do have a spiritual journey.
Yeah.
As for, you know, what we might come back as, I don't know, because I too have had different, there's periods of time, because I've done a lot of genealogy, and in fact, I went all the way back to William the Conqueror. I thought I was Italian and Irish in the beginning, and I am, but as it turns out, some of the branch of the Irish got up there, and the Scots-Irish that got all the way up there, way back at the Vikings and William the Conqueror. So there are things that feel familiar, places, things that feel familiar, like King Henry time. I sure hope I didn't lose my head. You know, back in the knights in that time, and there's some in the Viking time, and places and people, you know, that I'll go in, like you were talking about, you know, a place I've never been before that I go in that feels really familiar. And then usually I'll see something that makes it and more so, but I don't really stop to try to figure it out. Like, there's a lot of people here that know that a totem animal I have is a certain owl, not just any owl, but a little tiny, tiny owl called a screech owl. They're very small. And, for example, in a room I'll walk into that, or a place, another town, whatever, I walk into somewhere, it has that deja vu feeling, and you know you've never been there before. And then I'll see a sign, like there'll be a picture of an owl on the wall, or something that like validates the fact that I am familiar for some reason. Now, whether that's about reincarnation, and it certainly could be, or what that's about, it's a very interesting area to think about and to contemplate. And so I'm excited about your book, and everyone I would consider, anyone you know that likes the action thriller type book and is interested in, you know, this type of thing, life reviews and that sort of thing, but not in a heavy, we're doing it from the science, but from a thriller fiction sort of way, I think this would be a great gift for people like that. And I only know, again, remember my husband picked it up off of our counter and took it away without asking. So there are people that are just attracted by the book cover. Go look at the book cover and some of the interviews, and you might have just scratched a person or two off your Christmas list. But one thing I want to do real quick, and then I'll ask you, because we have this 15, we have 14 minutes left where we're streaming live. We can make things end by then, or we are allowed a certain amount of overtime. And I would ask you one more question after this, if you would stay. But
I will say as long as you'll have me, I'm having a really fascinating time.
Oh, good. Then let me say this to you out there listening. The show will, as you know, live cut off in 13 minutes. And so I'm going to hurry because I want to play the song before it cuts off.
Oh, right.
And yeah, I want to do that. But then anyone who wants to listen to the rest of the live show tonight, call in to 424-243-9540. Again, 424-243-9540. And you'll be able to listen to as long as we're talking. Otherwise, if you're up past your bedtime and you need to go to bed, but you're really interested in hearing, within an hour of the show being over, it'll be on demand on that same link forever. You click the link, there's a little slider. If you don't want to hear the whole interview again, take the slider down below and move it to the 120-minute point, and you'll be picking me up right here and hear the rest of the show. So tell us about this song and how it ties in. It's called Meteor Shower. It was one that I really liked a lot. I also liked the title cut off this album, but give us a little background or before I play this song so that everybody can hear it while we're live.
Sure. The full title is Walking in the Meteor Showers, and it is based on, there are two characters in the Karma Factor that in a previous lifetime had kind of grown up together, man and a woman, and they were just soulmates from day one. And then as they got older, something terrible happened that led to death and carnage, not because of anything evil or wrong they did, but there was a misestimation. It was basically done out of love, but there was a mistake made such that it alerted soldiers to where something was hidden. And so they went down in disgrace, and then next lifetime, when he's a cop, and she's an exotic dancer, because of what happened to her in the previous lifetime, what happened with her and soldiers and various things. And when they get back together, part of it, there's this incredible instinct to embrace and to get together and recognition. And then there's that other part that, what happened to them in the past? Something terrible happened because they were together, at least that was the thought. And so there's this push-pull thing going on between, oh, my God, I found you, and, oh, my God, I can't do this with you again. This is too dangerous. Look what happened last time. But they managed to work it out. But the song is about that aspect where they have this one moment where they go, oh, my God, let's just have this moment together, full blossom, full bloom. And so they are walking in the meteor showers, and they're having this moment, and that's what the song's about.
Awesome. Great. Well, I'm going to go on and play it, but the CD is called Hotel Earth, and again, I'm talking kind of slow. I'm going to have it run out when we do. Not actually when we do, but anyway. Follow along, kids. Okay. honest. Hotel Earth. So you want to check that out, too. That's a great cut. I love this song. It took me to a magical place to think of walking in the meteor shower. Got to get out of the city for that. So certainly. And I'm going to play that right now. Again, 424-243-9540. If you're going to hear the song before we go dark. For those of you who might be going to bed after this song is over, good night. God bless. I'll be back next Wednesday night. Thank you for listening. Check out the rest of this interview on demand anytime after about an hour from now. And I appreciate you being here. With that, I'm going to close you guys out with Thomas Lane in Walking in the Meteor Shower.
Let's go walking in the meteor showers. who could find me?
Sweet.
Makes me want
to go outside. That's beautiful. I really like that. Have you been walking in a meteor shower before? Just curious.
I saw some when I was up in Maine. And it is, you can't believe you're on the planet. You're just, it is so colorful and magical. You got nothing else that takes you in that place other than meteor showers that I've ever experienced.
Let me clarify something, because we still have a couple minutes on the air. Everybody, that song was by my guest who I've been interviewing, Thomas Lane. And that song was called Walking in the Meteor Showers, and it's off the CD called Hotel Earth. And at the beginning of the show, for those of you who might have come in later, I called him, well, he called him, but I just love that terminology, the multidimensional creative. And so we were talking, we've been talking about his book, The Karma Factor, tonight in the interview, but that was him doing his song right there. And so there was a bunch of people in the chat room who really love that song. Cool tune. How cool.
Good.
Wow.
It's
a great
under the name
song,
Tracker,
so,
by the way. They won't find it under Thomas Lane. They'll probably find it under Tracker, which is the stage name.
And I'm going to type that in. And for those of you listening, because we're doing this great under the wire. TRAKKER.
Right.
Tracker.
It's on Spotify, iTunes, all those places.
The usual haunts. So, make sure. TRAKKER, the regular music haunts. And it would be Thomas Lane, it would be Tracker, TRAKKER. Okay, thank you. So everybody's clear now. This is our multi-talented guest tonight. We were on the book. We stopped off to hear the song, and thank you. Yes, we'll be having this song. It's going to stay here on the playlist, so you'll hear it again, and I'll snatch a couple others and play those for you, too, as the weeks go on, and you'll be more familiar with Tom even after the interview tonight. So with that, that's about perfect. I think we have, she's going to tell me in my ear, I really hate it when we get in the middle of a sentence and cut people off.
Really?
Let me hear her. In any case, everybody in the chat really, really loved the song.
I'm so
Ten
glad.
10 seconds, good. So anyway, I just wanted to clear up any misunderstanding that was other than the same person. He is the same person. Extraordinaire, artist extraordinaire, singer, writer, author, screenplays. And now we are not streaming live, but you'll be hearing this. So I won't go on further in the archive.
Okay.
We're just continuing the interview as if this never happened. But before I let you go, only because we missed the front, I really wanted to get that done. Anything that you want to say about the book after this, but I did want to ask you about the third thing that you talked about, your involvement, and that's the Helen Hudson Foundation. And your work with the organization, and you said that it had something to do with the homeless, but it's interesting. I wanted to hear about what the organization does. I think I shared with you that I'm working on a unrelated to that, really, but kind of connected. It's funny, the interconnectedness
yep.
with certain people at a certain time and certain issues and things. But, you know, so many of the people that are homeless, and I was listening to some percentages, they were talking about the media is actually picking up on this. Oh, my God.
Yeah,
you know it's
serious yeah, they really
when
are.
They start
yeah.
talking about it. I
yep.
mean, they weren't before, but now they're talking
right.
about homelessness,
right.
mental illness.
Right.
And,
right.
you know, one of the things I've been saying, I went back to, you know, we started with straitjacket, tranquilizer chair, removing everyone's teeth in case the bacteria happened to make people insane, the Utica crib, shock
Jeez.
Treatments, lobotomy. And then, lo and behold, in the 50s, what replaced the lobotomy was Thorazine. And from that point forward through now, pharmaceuticals are the new lobotomy, and prison is the new
yeah.
asylum. And originally, asylums weren't meant. They were meant to be a place
mm-hmm.
that you went, chilled out, healed, you know, got some fresh air, some good nourishment, could dump your
yeah.
Psychological load and then go back out. It wasn't meant to be a place that you were going to be warehoused for the rest of your life and not get anything curative, only get custodial type of care, but along with that, a big dash of neglect, abuse, and worse. And the concept that honestly did start out as a good one so that we wouldn't have, and this is, I'm talking back in the early 1800s, and today we walk out in the street and see tent cities and see the prisons, probably half the people in prison have some form of mental illness or traumatic brain injury. While we're here
yeah.
on Brain Injury Radio,
yep.
you know, brain injury untreated and unchecked will lead to problems with conflict resolution and behavior issues.
Sure.
And, of course, in prison, there's no treatment. They're warehousing the way that it was done before. And so I was very interested in what your foundation does and what approach you're taking to homelessness.
Yeah, thank you for asking. It is an important blessing, and I really mean that in my life. The story mm-hmm. goes back to my family. How about that? My mother she was part of that PhD thing, but she was always, she was a relentless activist about all kinds of, you know, problems and biases and injustices. And, you know, we grew up with her marching against war. I actually, Martin Luther King's on the March on Washington, that entirely iconic moment in the movement. As a kid, mm-hmm. I ended up there, and I don't remember how I got there, but I was there for it. And I was, you know, this is what really got me into this whole racial divide thing. And while I was there, I didn't know it that my mother was also there. And so she's sitting, you know, right there, you know, with their hundreds of thousands of people, and I saw her sitting by herself, and I came up behind her, and I put my hands around her eyes and said, "Guess who?" And we flipped out. I mean, it was one of the great moments of mother's son. It was so beautiful, and Martin Luther King did his I Have a Dream. Anyway, I was really caught up in the whole racial
wow.
thing. And so she, as I said, she wrote letters to prisoners. I mean, she did it all. And she ended up working in soup kitchens in New Haven, Connecticut, which is where I was raised. And she, just because she was curious and she wanted to document things, she had published probably five or six other books, very small kind of intellectual, academic novels. And she had a real ability to put things together. And she decided she wanted to interview the guests. So she would, bless her heart, she would set up her little microphone and tape recorder in broom closets or in cars or anywhere she could get a moment with the man or woman she was interviewing and got their stories. And then she turned that into a manuscript, and she called it Dinner at 6, Voices from the Soup Kitchen. And when she presented that to her publisher didn't want to do it. It wasn't sexy. It wasn't academic. It was just kind of the raw thing. And I had read it, and I was really moved by it. And, you know, I was living in California at that point. And I took issue with the fact that this was really an important book. And if they're not going to do it, then we should do it as a family. And so and Mom was like, I don't know, you know, don't worry, you know. I said, no. So eventually we got it printed. We raised some money. We got it printed. And what we decided to do is not to make it a commercial venture, but to give it away, these books, to soup kitchens so that they in turn could sell them and keep the money. Mom didn't want a dime. And so, you know, it's basically, you know, a little bit of one-man band thing for me, but I just really, it was really something I believed in. And so I just started, you know, going to churches and places where they had soup kitchens, telling them about it. If they wanted books, I would give them the books for free. Or I would found out if there was a soup kitchen in Kansas that I could call them up, connect, and that they were interested, I would send them the books. And they would then use them for fundraisers or one thing or another. Anyway, 6 printings later, probably 100 organizations that signed up for the program, tens of thousands of dollars raised. I moved from New Haven. I was out in California, came back to New Haven, did the book, then moved up to Providence, Rhode Island, which is where I am now. And we started I had been doing this for 20 years. It was just out of the back of my car, just driving places, hearing about them, putting in the mail, talking to people, having wonderful success stories. I brought it up to Providence. There was some money in a trust account for my grandparents, so we call it the Helen Hudson Foundation. That's my mom's pen name. It's Helen Lane, but she wrote under the name Helen Hudson. And so we've been sort of, you know, getting this book out to soup kitchens everywhere. And then it just started to peter out in terms of people's interest. I'm not sure what that was. But I had befriended an organization called the Rhode Island Coalition to End Homelessness, and they had a speakers bureau where these speakers would go out and talk. Formerly homeless people would go out and talk to churches and schools and whatever and just tell them what it was like out there and just try to raise consciousness. And they were using the books for a while. And then the books dropped out, and there was all kinds of problems, and, you know, anyway, it circled around. It became under my wing for a while, and then I got it back, the Coalition to End Homelessness. And it's basically funding them to have these speakers learn to tell stories. We have a teacher, an amazing storyteller, who is now helping train these people, and, you know, they have their little organization, and they do the work. They go to the State House to make speeches, and it's just a wonderful, wonderful thing. And you know, I fell into it, and it's just some way of, you know, if I don't sell any books or records or anything, at least I can help these other organizations. It has grown. The mission statement changed from primarily homeless to anything and everything. I could fund the arts. I can fund ecological stuff. We don't have deep pockets, but it's been the most wonderful thing, you know, on top of my own passion for the arts and stuff, to be able to help in some small way with this organization.
And what's an idea about homelessness? You know, I heard an argument last night. It was kind of funny. And I will say I'm the middle of the road, so I won't be going political. I mean, I will say I'm an independent, but I have views on either side, but both sides. But last night, and on this thing I was working on, and then on the news last night, somebody who was on a very left-leaning network but has got fired and is on a new network that he says is this equally for both, that they play to the independents, but he brought himself with him. So it's not exactly like that.
I see what you're saying.
You know what I mean? It's going to take him a minute to, because I don't know if he was ever on, like on the other side, I know some of them started where he got fired from, and then they had to do a complete flip. You know, that must have been interesting, you know, for them to do. He hasn't completely done that yet. But anyway, it reminded me of, and I might have even told you this, but when Chris Cuomo was having the same conversation with Lisa Ling last night, it was about homelessness, and it was about a special she's got coming up on homelessness in her show that she's had. What is it? Life with... Anyway, whatever it is.
Yeah,
it's a pretty good show. I watch it.
Mm.
Yeah, whatever it is. You know, but they were talking politics, and I I'm working on a mental health book, and there is a horrible incident, typical, but not in 2022. I had been reading about these things, you know, back in the middle 1800s. And then when I heard this story in a town not too far away of similar treatment going on to children, you know, there was a couple of young Congress people, I think they were, and the governor is one party and these Congress people are the other party. And they were cited in this article blaming it all on one of the political parties. And, you know, I called them because they're kids, for one thing, and said, you know, I'd just like to comment about your comment. Like to try to help educate where I can, but this is a civil rights issue. It's not a political issue. And homeless didn't start today. And mental health issues didn't start today. And there's equal culpability in both parties and in society as a whole for ignoring it.
It's just blame
and not dealing with
tool.
It.
Blame
exactly.
is not an effective
exactly.
tool, you know. And
right.
I'm sorry to cut in. I just, you know, I'm a humanitarian. I'm a humanitarian, and I feel that that senior to all of this is that we are, or should be, caretakers of the planet, caretakers of each other. However, we can do that, but that's the sanctity of life needs to be right in the middle. That includes people, relationships, animals, rocks, plants, the whole thing. The whole political thing is just off base.
Exactly. And that's all I said, is that, you know, the one who's the hero is the one that steps up with the solution, not one that keeps pointing the fingers. That's been going on for decades, centuries, forever. You know, no party is better than the other on this. Everyone acts concerned, but nobody is doing anything about it. The situation hasn't changed. So to make a comment like that sounds very ignorant to the reality of the problem. You know, you sound like when the governor is on your team next year. then that team's going to do the same thing, you know, and it's gone back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. You know, so you should probably learn, learn about the things that are not political issues, they're people issues, and then when you have a solution, talk. And if you don't,
right,
ignore it like everybody else is. You know,
it's so tricky.
Shut up.
I mean, because I at the same time, if we don't vent, then nobody hears the problem, and people keep denial is a drug, and people are addicted to it, and it's because it's a whole lot easier to walk around in denial, no matter what your denial is about. But you know, I don't know. Sometimes it's time to raise my voice and yell if it's at the other party. And other times it's like transcending. It really sort of depends on the situation.
Well, they've all messed up. There's at least I can speak to the mental health part of it, in the same sentence. I mean, right now that governor I'm talking about that closed only because of a DOJ investigation about the 19th one, and it was an election year. I'm not blind to that. That governor is Republican. At the same time, back in lobotomy days, Joe Kennedy did the biggest sin on the planet when in the middle of the night he took his daughter, who was quote-unquote a little slow, didn't tell his family, didn't tell his wife, didn't tell anybody, took her to Dr. Freeman for a lobotomy and toasted her brain, made her a complete and total invalid the rest of her life because of his pride and his ego and the political jam of his family that she didn't fit into. So, you know, you could play ping pong all night long, you know, and nobody's come up with the solution. The sin is there for everybody. And, you know, for society back in the beginning of what I'm doing and probably similar, to what you're doing is that in the beginning, anybody who was less than status quo that made people feel uncomfortable, whether it was someone who had epilepsy, a physical disability, a mental disability, mental illness, looked different, was a different color, whatever, then you tucked them away, locked them up, threw away the key, and out of sight, out of mind was the answer for the status quo. While people were living through hell,
hasn't changed.
Robbed of their life. Well, the only thing that's changed is that now, I mean, yeah, they can lock some people up in prison, but with these tent cities popping up, and I haven't been to San Francisco lately, a couple decades ago, whenever the last time I was there, that was one of my most favorite cities at one point in my life. When I was younger, I adored that area, Carmel, Monterey, and then go up to San Francisco, whatever. You know, and some of the things that I see, on TV now, it ain't out of sight, out of mind, man. It's in your face. And so how do you not look for solutions? You know, at least in the 1800s, it was out of sight, out of mind. What this is telling me is all these hundreds of years later, it's in your face. And how can you ignore that? How can you ignore
that? Well, people find a way to, when I was first talking, I was saying, this is the big lie. It's a huge time for that, but it's also an incredible time for huge honesty. And what you're talking about is these people are there. They're in your face. In so many, there's so much going on now that has been slightly, even the racial thing, it's been pushed down, not given credence and in denial. And now it's just Black Lives Matter, Me Too. This is fantastic in terms of trying to get things to the surface so we all don't have the option of denial. Unfortunately, people can look at it and not see it, you know, because it's part of their perceptual apparatus. But I don't know. I am trying to do in my skill set, try to stay focused that, you know, that even if the pie of survival and we're going to get through this or not, including the climate stuff, even if that's only sort of 25% of the likelihood, I'm going to plant my flag there just because it seems the right thing to do. I feel so much better by being able to look at horror, but also be able to entertain hope. You know, and I'm sure you're like that too.
I am and I'm not. I don't know. We can have an argument now at the end of the night. No, not an argument. I think we could have a discussion. I don't know. You know, I'm a little torn on some things.
We all are. You know, how can you not be?
Well, I mean, being a woman, and I'm a little different. we've noticed that. Sorry. A little different than some of the things with the Me Too. You know, I grew up back with your mom in the bra burning generation. And one thing about me is I was an only child, so I didn't have a sex archetype I was supposed to follow. I was just had expectations of goals I was to reach. It didn't matter what package I was born with. There were certain objectives and goals and things I was expected to accomplish. And then when I was in the workforce, I worked on commission. And so it didn't matter if you were black, white, boy, girl, whatever. If you want to judge yourself on your income, on your paycheck, it was based on how hard you worked. And if you had the skill set. And so some of the things I hear now, just some of the things, sound like perpetual victimization to me.
Okay.
And there's some things that have happened to me in my life where I've genuinely been a victim. And if I wanted to run with that banner for the rest of my life, I would be righteous in being able to do so. But I'm more into moving forward. I don't want to be the victim. I was hurt enough at the point of impact of being a victim that I'm not going to give the power and whine about being a victim the rest of my life. I'm going to get off my ass and do something about it because nobody, you know, what government's going to do for me is teach me learned helplessness.
Yeah, let me clarify that because we're not – where I'm at is that the modality, the vehicles that we use and the things that we say are imperfect now. They're not in all things, and the victim is a big deal. But I think on balance, for me anyway, I'm Jewish, or part of me is Jewish, and I look just very much like I'm an Iranian or even mulatto or black. And I've had stones thrown at me, and, you know, I've had very uncomfortable situations just based on the way I look. As a kid, I thought people would throw stones at me because I went to a prep school, and they all had the sandy, you know, preppy hair and all that stuff. And I was you know, crinkly. I had, you know, a Brillo pad, they used to call me, because I had the hair, kinky hair and stuff. So, you know, I have had a bit of that. But with these movements now, they're crude. They're not formatted in a way that I believe in everything they're doing or saying. But it's putting the issue there. And I just believe the issue needs to be talked about. I'm in total agreement that when you get down to the nitty gritty, it's not about victimism. That's the worst thing. It's about, you know, standing up for your rights and having, but also not carrying it around, and that every, you know, guy that looks at you can't touch on your shoulder, you get swatted for this or that, or, you know, there's all kinds of stuff, but it's a start. It's the beginning of something that has been dormant and unable to express itself. You know, and it was just like when in the 60s, when the Black Panthers came out, and they were scary as hell, and they wanted to kill Whitey. At the same time, it was like that woke up certain people. It's unfortunate that that had to do it, but that what it's like to carry that particular torch. You know what I'm saying?
I do. It's just the way it's presented. It's not a solution. You know, when you talked about what you talked about in childhood, my cross was that I was cute and blonde, so people assumed I was dumb.
Oh,
okay. I'm a girl. I'm blonde. I'm dumb. Blonde equals dumb. You know, and now, and I'm not, I will say I'm not a racist. My parents grew up in poverty, and their school was very diverse. And my dad was athletic, and he was probably one of two white guys on the, you know, on the basketball team and track and baseball and the sports, you know, that he played. So my parents went to that school, and they were colorblind, and I grew up to not be that way. And so now to be empathetic and want to listen and be called a Karen and have white guys slam dunked, you know, there was some doughboy white boys. There was the dumb jock, okay? You know, I mean, everybody has had their share of heat in their day, but I don't think it's a good way to try to open a dialogue of understanding and compassion to do the same thing. Two wrongs don't make a right, you know, to take on an attitude of, here, you know, you're a Karen and you're whatever they call the white guys. You know, that's going to make it better. You want to see how it feels. It's like, no, I want to meet you on an equal footing for an adult conversation where we can really get some understanding instead of the walls going up instantly and everybody being on the defensive. That doesn't change anything. I'd like to see the change that they're talking about, but the presentation
do you not
helpful.
I'm sorry. I don't disagree with you. I just feel we're not at that stage yet. That first comes the avalanche of pent up this and that, and then as it matures, it goes into more. And these are horrible generalities. I mean, I can't talk about a gender or race or whatever. It's all individual. But the arc of this, the fact that, you know, that these people are talking about it and you know, trying to get laws that allow for certain things to occur because there's protest and anger and discord, that's the opening salvo. And I agree with you totally. I believe in discourse and gentility and compassion, all those things. I don't think these particular movements are not there yet. There are plenty of women that I know that are, you know, have expressed exactly what you're talking about. But at the same time, that's not where the majority are, I guess, on any of these issues because of the baggage that has partly, you know, that has been bestowed upon them. And family scenes or whatever, it's cultural, it's hip to be part of it, I mean, whatever the consideration is. But anyway, I get it. I know what you're saying.
Well, it also trends, I guess, when you're older and you've been through it twice. You know, I've been through it twice. It's like, geez, because there has been change from that day you and your mom were at Martin Luther King to today. But a lot of the young people are just caught up in the wave right now, and they don't realize there have been changes. And one of the things, two things that make me sad is one of them is that there are a lot of minorities who have risen to great pinnacles that back when you were talking about, you know, might not have been imagined, and yet there they are, you know, in very high offices, high places in the military, you know, very, they've worked hard, maybe harder than your average person, and they've gotten to a pinnacle, and they've broken the stigma and the stereotype, and their own side are the ones that have derogatory things to say about them, not the others. They accuse them of being white, you know, for being successful.
All they did was work.
You know, they worked, and that's what we all do is, you know, and then with women, I've had a couple interesting shows, and then I'll shut up, but a couple interesting shows lately about men who are really messed up in this day and age. You don't hear them talking about it, you know, but my husband and you are probably lucky that you're not single, because they don't know how to be. White guys don't know how to be right now. Right, they've been demasculated in some ways, or their role.
I bring that up.
It's turned upside down.
It's upside down. Well, you know, in terms of a cultural mandate, the women have the cause of equality and parity and things like that. What are men supposed to do? They don't know. I mean, because, you know, having been one, and I was a jock when I was a kid, and I was all about this and get the girl and all that kind of stuff, and to a point where, you know, that was what I was supposed to do. And then as I began to mature, I found, you know, spirituality, which is non-denominational and non-bias.
Right.
It just does. It has nothing to do with these divisive things. Because of the inclusion of all diversity, and to a point where I remember when I was really 20 years old or so, and I wrote Playboy magazine a letter saying, "You are using these women as sort of capitalistic tools to get rich and building up stereotypes and putting pressure on men that they should go with girls like that and girls should look like, you know, the whole nine yards." And I made a break from all of that, and it has served me well. But I think most guys do not have the leadership where just tenderness is real and allowable, and intimacy. These are lost arts for a lot of guys, and they do not have the skill set that a woman gains having a nest and having responsibility and, you know, just a whole different set. And guys who were out there being providers and this and that, and money makers, this and that, that doesn't work no more. I mean, there's still plenty of folks who are doing it. But in terms of a sense of feeling good and truly feeling good and truly deeply feeling authentic, it's a lost, you know, you get lost in that. And I see that in a lot of people, a lot of guys.
Well, again, I think being older, and I was the person being interviewed on a veteran I've had on my show a few times, and he's doing a podcast on guys with that have lost themselves as far as, you know, relationships with women and not knowing how to be. And I feel for them, you know, I got comfortable in my own skin as a woman a long time ago and didn't feel like I needed to compete with a man. Can I open my own door? Sure. Am I offended if a guy does that for me? Absolutely not.
Good.
You know,
perfect.
Or opens the door for me. You know, I appreciate that. There's certain romantic, I don't know what you'd call it, things that guys did in the past that some women find offensive now that I don't. There's no doubt I can pull out my own chair. There's no doubt I can open up my own car door, but I don't mind that. It helps a man tap into, like you said, his sensitivity and his respectful nature. And I hate to see that get erased and all these guys being so confused, because there's not a competition. It shouldn't be a competition. You know, to me, men are men and women are women, and we have our places, and it's our thing to feel comfortable in our own skin. But it's really hard when you don't know, you know, whether to open a car door for a gal, whether you're going to get smacked or hugged for doing it.
You really nailed it. What becomes the nuance of that gesture is, where is it coming from the guy? Is he trying to do a power play? Is he being civil? You know, it takes a very quick and very astute mind to make a difference like that. It's where if you're secure enough in your identity and the guy opens the door, you don't have to prove one thing or another. You know, you could, as you just said, you can open it for yourself. But it's, you know, so many of these things, I feel like we're just seeing a snapshot, and that we're a work in progress. As a matter of fact, in the Karma Factor book at the very end, I do hope you have a chance to read it.
Detective James Early, when I get it away from my husband.
Tell him he's being sexist, a sexist pig. Give me the fucking book, you know. Sorry.
Actually, I'm comfortable with him reading it first.
Okay. Anyway, at the very end, he's walking down the street. He's kind of torn up, and he's done well, put it that way. He's got conflicting things, and he stops for a moment, looks around, and says, It's a work in progress. It's all a work in progress. I'm a work in progress. This city is a work in progress. This universe is a work in progress. And, you know, I try to get to that viewpoint where, you know, it's not perfect now, but, if things go right, that we'll work out this man-woman thing, and men will get an identity situation, which is much more a composite of wonderful attributes and difficulties, whatever, but the sensitivity gene and intimacy and, you know, just paying attention to what's happening in front of you becomes more realized, you know, hopefully through generations.
Yeah, and I hope that comes. We do kind of have to wind it up now. I think I have about this much overtime, but you know, it's just until that part gets straightened out, there's going to be friction in relationships. And when there's friction in relationships, there's friction in families.
Yep.
And then a lot of the things we're talking about are in the problem, not the solution, because we want the healthy relationships. We want the healthy families that stay together so we don't have some of these underlying problems we were talking about, because that's kind of the root of a lot of it. So I'm all for happy relationships and solid families and good communication. So I hope everyone figures it out. I thank God that it took me 45 years. but
you did it. You did it. And I really meant, you know, when I said that in the beginning about you and your space and your courage, you know, it really, I think your show is just, helping a lot of people.
Thank you. I hear that from some people, and that makes everything worthwhile, but I couldn't do it without, you know, I'm a conduit for bringing people like you on the show that help change people's minds, change people's lives, make them more open-minded, broaden their scope and their horizon. And, you know, that's what I'm good at doing is network and meeting cool people and being blessed by meeting Craig in the first place and, you know, having a venue to bring those people that are game changers for other people. And we're all about service and wanting to make life better for people, you know.
Amen.
So,
absolutely.
Really appreciate you. I really appreciate you, period. And thank you for being on the show tonight.
Well, you fell on the sword. You blamed yourself about making a miss something. It was totally my fault. I couldn't believe you said that. You're so kind. I was going to refute that, but I decided not to. But you said...
Well, you just did. This is on tape. Stop it.
Oh, we'll erase
this
that.
This is in
then.
The archive. This is in the archive.
Okay.
I can't.
Don't...
We don't do that.
That last minute, please take it off. Whatever. Anyway, I sent you a CD, the Hotel Earth CD. Unfortunately, due to weather or some such, it's still delayed and on its way to you, but it will arrive someday.
And I really appreciate that. I'll be probably putting in some holiday music to play here and there for the next 30 days, and my new artists when you come. But I've had a long-going playlist, like you just heard John, and I'm really appreciative of that. And from the response in my chat room, everybody really loved your music. So hopefully you'll be getting gifted, whether it's music, book, or both. I appreciate your talent and the time and the conversations that we've had. So happy holidays, and I hope we can stay in touch.
Sounds good to me. So thanks again.
All right.
Take care. All right. Bye for now.
All right. Good night.
Bye-bye.
Everybody check out thomaslane.com. Again, that's thomaslane.com. Good night and good night and God bless. We will see you next week. Good night.